back. My name is Lori Newman. I'm with the Division of STD Prevention as well. And I'll be talking today about the epidemiology of gonorrhea. So as all of you are probably well aware, the sequela of untreated gonorrhea infection includes pelvic inflammatory disease, infertility, and chronic pelvic pain. Gonorrhea increases the risk of HIV transmission and acquisition. And unfortunately, gonorrhea is the second most common reportable notifiable disease. For years, we saw dramatic decreases in gonorrhea in the 70s and 80s, due in part to a widespread gonorrhea control program that involved extensive screening activities. However, what we've seen over the past 10 years has been extremely concerning, which is we've essentially flatlined out, and we have been unable to continue to decrease the gonorrhea rate to reach our goal of 19 cases per 100,000 population, which is the Healthy People 2010 goal. And we are still, and it's these flat last 10 years that I'm going to be looking at more closely today in most of the slides to get a better understanding of what is going on. As we can see here, for years, gonorrhea rates were much higher among men than they were among women. But for the last 7 years, however, we have seen slightly higher rates among women than we have seen among men. Currently, the rate among women, we anticipate for 2007 that it'll be around 120 per 100,000 population, whereas for men it'll be around 110 per 100,000 population. These are very rough estimates, and by the end of the close of the year, we anticipate these rates may have changed slightly. So all 2007 data is preliminary right now. When we look at gonorrhea by age and sex, for 2006, we see that the highest rates for men were in the 20 to 24-year-old men, and the highest rates for women were in the 15 to 19-year-old as well as the 20 to 24-year-old women. And together, the 15 to 24-year-old age group accounts for 68% of all gonorrhea and morbidity in women. And for men, that age group, the 15 to 24-year-old age group, accounts for 46% of all morbidity. So clearly, gonorrhea is a disease of adolescents and young adults. When we look at the proportion of reported gonorrhea cases from STD clinics by sex, we see that over time, in both men and women, we have seen a steady decline in the proportion of gonorrhea cases being reported from STD clinics. The inverse of that statement is that we're seeing a lot more coming out of the private, a lot more of diagnosis of gonorrhea is being done in the private sector. Currently, for males, about 35% of all gonorrhea is being diagnosed in STD clinics, and for females, that's only about 16% of gonorrhea is being diagnosed in the public sector. So we really cannot forget our private sector peers and other settings. When we look at gonorrhea by state, we see, unfortunately, only four states and one territory have reached the Healthy People 2010 goal of 19 cases per 100,000 population, those lucky few states. The majority, the highest gonorrhea rates are in the South and in the Midwest, which is an important pattern to recognize. When we look at this more closely, however, I think this is a really interesting map because you see a lot of heterogeneity of gonorrhea rates. What you find is that 40% of counties in the U.S. have actually met the Healthy People 2010 goals, and that that gonorrhea is really focused in it can be very county specific, but again, it still involves predominantly southern states. When we look at, this is IPP data, similar to what Catherine showed earlier, but this is for gonorrhea. I'm showing positivity among 15 to 24-year-old women tested in family planning clinics by state. And again, positivity data is the number of positive gonorrhea tests over the total number of gonorrhea tests performed. It's only a proxy for prevalence of disease in a population. But again, this is a different way of looking at data, and it's a way of getting around kind of reporting biases that you asked about earlier. And here again, we see that the highest rates are in the South. When we look at gonorrhea rates by region, we see that traditionally the South has always had the highest gonorrhea rates, but I don't think, unfortunately, we should also take note that the Midwest has gonorrhea rates almost as high as we see in the South. I'm looking at rates by region a little closer because what happens, it gets a little crunched down in there, and I think it's easier to see if you look at this. If you came to this talk 2 years ago, you would have heard me spend a fair amount of time talking about the increases in gonorrhea that we're seeing in the West. We did an extensive, a fairly in-depth look at 8 Western states were seeing increases because these states, they saw about a 42% increase between 2000 and 2005. We were very concerned about that. It's interesting. It appears to have plateaued. And another area that we had been interested in was in the South. We saw that little blip in the South between 2005 and 2006. Luckily, that appears to have stabilized as well. However, this increase in the West really led to a lot of very interesting questions about what was going on with gonorrhea. And we decided to look at this in more depth in one state, which was in Utah, because Utah had a 261% increase in their gonorrhea rate between 2000 and 2006. This was higher than any other state in the country. We wanted to understand better what was going on. Even though we knew gonorrhea rates in Utah, as in most of these Western states, are much lower than seen in any other in other regions of the country, we still thought this was very important, and it might be a chance to understand a little bit about what's driving gonorrhea epidemiology. And what I'm not going to show here, but from the Utah data, are that basically we saw this kind of an increase in both males and females. We saw it across age groups. We saw increases like this in both MSM and heterosexuals. And we saw it across races and ethnicities in Utah. So the one area that was intriguing to us had to do with when you looked at reported cases of gonorrhea by provider type. And what we saw there was in the private sector, that purple line, we saw a 667% increase in the number of cases that were reported in the private sector. And that's in contrast to what we saw in the STD clinic, the pink line, where we saw only a 67% increase in the number of cases. What we decided to do is say, okay, what can we learn from the private sector? So we went, Utah had was able to get data from a private reference laboratory. This private care setting, this network of clinics in Utah, reported in 2006 about 15% of all gonorrhea morbidity for that area. And when you looked at the number of gonorrhea tests being done in this care setting, we found a 424% increase in the volume of gonorrhea testing being done in this care setting. And in contrast, I'm not going to show those data right now, but in contrast, in the public health laboratories in Utah, they only saw a 125% increase in test volume. These are all relative. but increases across the board in gonorrhea testing, but more striking in the private sector. We decided we needed to look at this on a national level as well and wanted to see what we could see there. What I'm showing here is the proportion of gonorrhea tests using non-culture methods and gonorrhea test volume from the American Public Health Laboratory Survey. These are all public health labs, majority are public health laboratories, and this was done in 2000 and 2004. When we look at those data, we saw that in the year 2000, the percent of tests that were conducted using non-culture methods was about 82%, and that increased over the course of 4 years to about 91.5%, so that did see some increase. And what we saw in terms of gonorrhea test volume was, again, it started at about 3 million and it went up to about 3.5 million. We saw these increases in both proportion and volume of gonorrhea testing being done more striking when we subset this just to Western states that had continuously participating labs throughout the time period. So this is even more striking when you look at it for just some of these Western states. So there is some regional variation in what you see in terms of laboratory testing practices. Another national laboratory database that we had access to that we are looking at this in has to do with the IPP data. And we looked at reported gonorrhea and chlamydia test volume from 2001 to 2006. And what we saw here was that over that time period, we've seen a 76% increase in gonorrhea test volume, and that's as compared to chlamydia, where we saw a 30% increase in chlamydia test volume. Clearly, it'd be nice to have access to some private data sources to kind of document what's going on there as well. But this is an interesting phenomena, and it most certainly is playing into something that we saw earlier, which is these gonorrhea rates by sex, gonorrhea rates overall. You cannot talk about the epidemiology of gonorrhea without addressing probably the most striking aspect of gonorrhea epidemiology, which has to do with looking at gonorrhea rates by race and ethnicity. Gonorrhea rates in black have come down dramatically in the 80s, but we have unfortunately flatlined out there, and we are still looking at rates in blacks that are, in 2007, 19 times higher in blacks than they are in whites. And this is an extremely concerning and persistent situation. When we look at how this translates down to kind of a local level, if let's say we look at gonorrhea rates for females who are between the ages of 15 and 19 years old by region and race and ethnicity, when we look at this, we see that across the board, rates for these 15 to 19 year old females are higher for all in all regions of the country. They're higher for black young women than they are for women of other races. And then another way of translating this is if you look at young black women in the Midwest, over 4% of young women in the Midwest had a reported case of gonorrhea in 2006. This does not take into account the cases of gonorrhea that were not reported. And this proportion is of all women that age. It does not take into account the proportion that not all of these women were sexually active and therefore not at risk. So this is a very high and a very important problem for this population. Another, you can do that same thing for men. I looked at 20 to 24-year-old men, and again, you see that across the country, rates for 20 to 24-year-old black men were higher in every region of the country than they were for other races. And when you calculate the rate ratio, like Hillard presented, the ratio of disease in blacks to the disease in whites, in young men of this age, rates of gonorrhea are 40 times higher than they are for young white men. And that racial disparity, it needs to be addressed and needs to be talked about and thought about and discussed. A lot of these data, though, are the result of just basic demographics and who we have living in what parts of what country, what parts of the country. And so what we tried, one of the things I tried to do and to try and understand racial disparities in gonorrhea a little bit better was to look at let's say we looked at black communities. What do we see in black communities? And so one way of just an arbitrary way of defining what a black community is was to look at counties where at least 15% of the population was African American. And in that setting, we found that 95.6, just looking at black counties, we found that 95.6% of them had rates higher than 100 per 100,000 population. When you do the same kind of thing, but you look at white communities, and by that we just picked a cutoff of white communities being counties where greater than 80% of the community is white, we found that only 5.5% of those counties had gonorrhea rates, very high gonorrhea rates. And what that means to me is that most counties in the U.S. are not going to prioritize gonorrhea as a public health priority because they're a white community that doesn't see this as a priority. And what it suggests to me is that these counties that are African American counties that are severely affected by this need to be aware of it and may need to take it on themselves and advocate and rally to make this bring it up on the public health priority list and make sure that people recognize this as a problem and talk about it. So what else do we know about gonorrhea? So far, all I've been talking about is case report data and some IPP data for the most part. And in those kinds of data, all we can tell you is about sex and age and a very crude reporting source. Is this an STD clinic or not? We can talk about race, ethnicity. But then after that, the quality of our data drop off or are non-existent. So what we did at CDC was to set up something called the STD Surveillance Network. And I'll call it SUN. And the purpose of SUN was to improve our national capacity to detect, monitor, and respond to emerging trends in STDs and related behaviors. So one of the SUN activities that I'll present a little bit of data on today, and then tomorrow I have a whole 10 minutes to get to talk about it, is a population-based enhanced gonorrhea surveillance activity that we've started. And basically, this is a sample of patients reported with gonorrhea in some selected counties across the country. And we are excluding patients who attended the primary STD clinics. We're really interested about what's going on in the non-STD clinic sector. We want to be able to define what that is and what gonorrhea means in these other settings, because increasingly that is so important. And we have another surveillance activity to look at just STD clinics. And I'm going to show you data today from February 2006 through December 2007. But this is an ongoing project, and this is really just a single point in time, a baseline set of data, and this is an ongoing activity. And I hope in 2 years to be able to talk a little bit more about trends and what we see. So these are the sun sites. We have five of the six sun sites are conducting this population-based gonorrhea surveillance. New York City is not doing this. But in these five sites, we have a total of 11 counties that I'll be showing you data from. And just something to comment on. In this sun activity, we're basically interviewing gonorrhea patients. And I just have to say that we're only able to interview about 30% of gonorrhea patients. It turns out it's a very hard thing to do. It's very hard to track them down. So the data I'm showing you is about a 30% response rate. So when we look at the sex and sexual orientation of sun-interviewed gonorrhea patients, what we see is that on average about 20% of gonorrhea patients outside the STD clinic setting are men who have sex with men. When we look at the provider and let me just make one point, and this is very different than what you see in syphilis, for example, where we're starting to get sexual orientation data and we're seeing about two-thirds of those patients, of syphilis patients, are men who have sex with men. When we look at the provider type of sun-interviewed gonorrhea patients, and again, this is excluding the proportion that we are just looking at those patients outside the STD clinic setting. And this, when we look at this other category of patients, we see that a third of them were diagnosed in the ER and urgent care setting. More of them were diagnosed in primary care settings. That's extremely concerning if any of you think about what kind of services are offered in ER and urgent care settings in terms of continuity care and partner management and the ability to track and document these patients and get back with them and get their partners treated. I think this has very important implications for us programmatically to think about this. And this varies a little bit by sex, but it varies dramatically by race and ethnicity. And again, I'll save those data for tomorrow. When we look at the reported risk behaviors over the past 3 months by sun-interviewed gonorrhea patients, we see some very interesting stuff. We see that the mean number of sex partners for MSM is much higher than it is for heterosexual patients with gonorrhea. We see that MSM were much more likely to have met their sex partner through the internet than were heterosexual men and women. However, heterosexual men and women were much more likely to report recent incarceration of themselves or their most recent sex partner. And that's a very concerning association between gonorrhea and this risky reported history. In terms of anonymous sex, we see across the board, I think it's pretty high across the board in heterosexual and MSM populations, the amount of reported anonymous sex over the past 3 months. And in contrast to kind of what we've always been talking about, we've always talked about exchange of sex, only very small proportions of patients are either reporting having received or offered exchange of sex for drugs or money. In sum, the national gonorrhea rate remains stable, but we are still very, very far from our healthy people 2010 goal of 19 cases per 100,000 population. And we think that in part some of that may be to some large increases in gonorrhea test volume that we've been seeing. But in many of these settings, and what I didn't talk about is that we have much better data on gonorrhea test volume than we did have on changes in behavior and changes in risk behaviors over time. So I don't think we can attribute this solely, what we're seeing in gonorrhea, solely to changes in test volume. But this is definitely having changes in testing practices is definitely affecting what we see in gonorrhea epidemiology. And we continue to see concerning and persistent racial disparities. And we really need to think about the high burden of disease among Black adolescents and young adults in all regions of the country. A large proportion of gonorrhea is being diagnosed in ER and urgent care settings, and I think it behooves all of us to really think about what is going on in these ER settings. I want to bring attention to a poster by Jennifer Donnelly in Colorado that it looks at gonorrhea in diagnosed in these care settings and what implications that has for the chance of these patients being tested for HIV. And we're also seeing some very concerning associations with high-risk behaviors that we can only kind of pick up in a system like this, but we hope that some of our colleagues will continue to investigate in other settings and other realms. In terms of what current CDC is currently doing about some of this gonorrhea epidemiology, is, as I said before, we've set up this enhanced gonorrhea surveillance system. Sun is very important to us, and we're hoping to be able, with trends over time, to be able to say more things about what's going on with the epidemiology of gonorrhea. CDC is working a cross-branch collaboration to to design and implement a brief gonorrhea, chlamydia interview record template that we want to be able to make available to all of you to encourage the uniform collection of clinical and behavioral data on patients with gonorrhea and chlamydia, and hoping that it'll allow both us and you to be able to analyze trends in gonorrhea. We have a 2007 APHL laboratory survey, which has been conducted, and we will hopefully over the next couple months be able to look at, be able to share that information with everyone in terms of what's going on with laboratory practices. And we are, as John Douglas mentioned this morning, we are very actively trying to develop an STD disparities plan of action that I, from my perspective, has the most potential impact for gonorrhea of all the STDs. I think this is especially near and dear to my heart. And we hope that the kinds of things we're talking about in that plan of action are things like what kinds of toolkits can we make available? Is it time for some screening guidelines? How can we help raise community awareness of these problems? So anyway, thank you very much to all the people who helped contribute to the many different sources of data involved in this. Does anybody have any questions about gonorrhea? Don't tell me you saved all your questions. You wasted all your questions on syphilis and chlamydia. Thank
you. Hi, I'm Sarah Hemlisch. I am from California. And in California, we've been doing a comprehensive survey of all of our laboratories, not just public health laboratories, since 1996. And we found that mass testing was widely adopted by everybody, including private sector laboratories, starting in about 2000, which corresponds with when we saw the increase in Western states. And I'm wondering, because California is the most populous state in the West, and probably driving a lot of that, we can come to that because it's not important.
I think when we did this MMWR, we did this kind of eight-state collaboration with to look at some of these issues across a bunch of different Western states. And when we looked at that, we saw this massive increase in the use of NAT testing. And that certainly is picking up more disease. I mean, I really do think more people are getting tested for gonorrhea than ever before. Dual test technology, they're slightly more sensitive tests, but really I think what's going on, and people are getting tested who may have refused to get tested before when it involved a probe or a speculum exam. So with urine-based testing, certainly more people are getting tested for gonorrhea. That is certainly driving some of this. But when we looked at what was going on in these Western states, there was nobody that was totally, I shouldn't say nobody. There were very few people who were comfortable saying, yeah, it's just the result of increased testing. There's not more disease going on there. Most people at the state and local level, when you talk with them, say, we're seeing gonorrhea in populations we didn't see it before, and we think something is going on. We're seeing very concerning trends in risk behaviors. We tried to get a proxy measure of this. It's very hard to do when you're talking about different states with different data sources. So what we tried to do is look at symptomatic males. Symptomatic males shouldn't be subject to screening guidelines or screening practices. Symptomatic males tend to go in and get care for their very concerning symptoms. And so we think that that's independent of screening practices. And we tried to look at trends and numbers of symptomatic males. And in most of these areas, or most of the settings that we could look at this in, we saw increases in the number of symptomatic males. So we think more people are getting infected than has been in the past. But again, it's very hard to tease out. But we suspect there are some changes in risk behavior that may be going on. In California, some of their enhanced gonorrhea surveillance is very interesting. Michael Samuel is going to talk about some of that tomorrow. And I think that's worth listening to for people who are interested in this topic, because I think they've seen, again, some associations with incarceration and maybe methamphetamine use and so forth. But again, it's very hard to document risk behavior and how it impacts changes in gonorrhea epidemiology. Yeah.
Directly counseling service and so on, and seeing young men who come into health service is not that many, because a lot of them really don't come as much as the young ladies do. I wanted to know some practical solutions or some things that we could do, in your opinion, at the university to make the young men aware of the testing, make the young men aware of what the symptoms are, with a real practical application of the presentation that you just made. Thank you.
Thank you. That's great. I mean, I love to hear questions from people who are in the who are actually there and can be actually doing things that can make a difference in the field. And the field is, our field is, includes historically black colleges and universities. I think one part is raising awareness. I mean, if you ask what a lot of these college students know about gonorrhea, it is very little. It's not talked about. It's just one of those things. And I think raising awareness of how high rates are for these populations. And that I think another very important aspect of this is that it's not your risk of gonorrhea if you're African American is not necessarily very closely correlated to your risk behavior. There's a lot of data out now that suggests that African American women who only have one sexual partner are at much higher risk of acquiring gonorrhea than are their white counterparts with also who have one sexual partner. So it's not an African American woman is at high risk even if she only has one sexual partner. And I think because it's a network phenomenon, it's not her individual risk behavior that is putting her. So I think you need to get this message across that it's just not the naughty and the bad that are at risk. This is just a population phenomena, and because of who you are and what your sexual network happens to be, you are at risk. It's not because you yourself. And I think that's a very important awareness of understanding the epidemiology and what is going on behind it. Don't use the words epidemiology with these students. But I think you need to bring it out. And I think you also need to, and I think you can really work with, I bet there are young women's groups on these campuses and young men's group who would be willing to take this up as a issue and a concern. And this affects their future fertility. This, you know, STDs can be very devastating to young adults. I think it needs to be talked about, and maybe finding peer-to-peer kind of, there are many, many different role models out there of Sister Song, Sister Love. They do some great work and have some great connections and models of how to work in college, in university settings to increase awareness and increase testing and screening in these populations. Thanks. Back there. So the question was, were we able to go out to these settings in Utah, and some of these other settings, these private settings in Utah, and find out what changed and why their screening volume was increasing so much? I have to say that as a first pass of what we looked at in Utah, our first pass was to look at these data sources, figure out what's going on, and we spent a lot of time talking with the health department people in the counties that were affected. I don't know if anyone from Utah is in the room here today. I don't necessarily see anybody. And I think that they are now actively trying to meet with some of Utah is very concerned about what's going on with their gonorrhea, and they are actively trying to meet with some of these private sector folks. It's just a little bit more difficult to get access to these settings. And no, when we were, our EIS officer and Rula Lepia didn't get to that level of depth in it. And I think that Utah is continuing to do this, but and trying to get access to more providers and more data and get a very more qualitative sense of what's going on. But no, we don't have a great answer for that right now. Over there in the red. Thank you. Both very good questions. So the first question has to do with ER settings. The tell me again what your question was. Sorry. Yeah, I knew I should have stopped you after the first one. Right. We don't, on our, all we can say, we didn't ask patients, we didn't interview them about their gonorrhea, their insurance status. Those are very hard questions to ask, and most people actually, but what we are planning to do actually with the data are to, we are going to geocode the addresses of these patients and down to the census tract level and maybe tie in some measures of insurance and access to care and look at some of that. And it's incredibly interesting. And some of this is actually done a little bit easier at the local level, but certainly that's one of the, absolutely, we just spent a lot of time talking about that on Sunday, about how we were going to get at some of those issues. The second part of your question has to do with other populations such as Native Americans, and I would also broaden that to be Hispanics and other minority populations. Is our STD disparities plan of action going to cover some of these other groups? And absolutely. We, as a first step, we didn't want to get overwhelmed. And we feel like we're focusing in on a single community right now and developing a plan of action that we absolutely, that we can feel like we're learning and developing templates and processes and priority setting processes. But we absolutely intend to expand that to other races and other ethnicities and other types of minority groups that experience disparities. And in fact, our disparities, once we have a disparities coordinator on board in the division, absolutely, their job is not just for blacks to look out for disparities in blacks, but it is also to then look at some of these other populations. So it's been framed as the starting point was in black communities, but we're also very, very interested in some of the disparities in other communities as well, and we'll absolutely include this. Okay, thank you very much. Thank you.